Good morning, Mendocino. This is Jeff Blankford, welcoming you to the July 13th edition of Takes on the World, a public affairs program that comes your way the second and fourth Wednesdays of every month, and every other fifth Wednesday when I open the phones to you, our listeners. Last Wednesday, the New York Times carried a front-page article with the optimistic headline, Better Lives for Mexicans Cut a Lure of Going North, with a subhead reading, Shifts in Jobs and Education are Cited to Decline of Illegal Traffic to U.S., end quote. Situation, however, is not as rosy as at times writers would like to its readers to believe, and it's not just Mexicans, but Salvadorans and Guatemalans as well, who for years have attempted to cross our borders illegally to seek relief from poverty and starvation in their own countries. What happens when they do try to do so can not only be a living nightmare, but also a deadly one. This morning at about 20 minutes past the hour, we'll be getting some first-hand information about that when I speak with Natalie Teeter and Michael Villegas, two students from San Francisco State College of Ethnic Studies, who have just returned from Tucson, Arizona, where they volunteer with No More Deaths, a nonprofit group that works to end the death and suffering of undocumented immigrants on the U.S.-Mexico border. There's another kind of suffering that has been going on for years, right within our borders, and that's inside the walls of the California prison system, where in too many instances a cruel and inhumane punishment has been the order of the day. 4 hours north of here, close to Crescent City, set in an idyllic forest near the Oregon border, sits one of the country's most regressive prisons, Pelican Bay, where inmates in the secure housing units, commonly referred to as the SHU, are closeted in 8x10 feet windowless cement cells 22 hours a day. And this is not just a temporary punishment for prisoners who act up. Some men have not only been living in these cells since a prison opened in 1989, they were held under similar conditions in other state prisons before Pelican Bay opened. They finally decided to do something about it, and on July 1st, they went on a hunger strike that has now spread to at least a third of the state's 33 prisons, involving close to 7,000 prisoners. Their demands include an end to the interrogation process, which is used to claim prisoners' gang affiliation, an end to long-term isolation following the recommendations of a U.S. Commission on Safety and Abuse in Prisons report, and access to healthy food and normal prison programs and privileges. Speaking for his fellow prisoners, Pelican Bay hunger strike leader Todd Ashker said in a statement released by lawyers for the Prisoner Hunger Strike Solidarity Coalition, quote, the basis for this protest has come about after over 25 years, some of us 30, some up to 40 years, of being subjected to these conditions. Of our 602 appeals, numerous court challenges have gotten nowhere. A lot of us are older now. We have serious medical issues coming on. There's a core group of us who are committed to taking this all the way to the death, if necessary. End quote. One of those prisoners, Hugo Pinel, came to this country from Nicaragua when he was 12. He's the last remaining member in prison of what became known as the San Quentin Six, six prisoners who were indicted for participating in the rebellion in San Quentin's secure housing unit in August 1971, when Black Panther George Gax Jackson was gunned down by prison guards. Three others I happen to know, David Johnson, Luis Talamantes, and Willie Tate, have been out of prison for some years now, leading peaceful, productive lives. Pinel, now 64, has been locked up in California prisons for 45 years and in January was denied parole for the ninth time. Due to a new state law passed by the voters in November, he will not be eligible for another parole hearing until 2026. Okay, let's move overseas where a plea has been sent out by Marin County resident Regina Carey and retired Army Colonel Ann Wright, who you may have heard on these airwaves. They are two of the American women who have chosen to remain on the Audacity of Hope after it was seized on July 1st by the Greek Coast Guard when it tried to sail to Gaza and break the Israeli blockade. In a message from Athens yesterday, Carey and Colonel Wright wrote that, quote, at 10 a.m. today, the shore electricity was cut off to the Audacity of Hope, the U.S. boat to Gaza, leaving us with no power. The boat has been imprisoned at the U.S. Embassy Greek Coast Guard dock near Perieus Greek, just outside of Athens, since we tried to sail to Gaza on July 1st, and the Greek Coast Guard intercepted our small boat and hauled us into this compound. It's over 100 degrees inside the boat, they write, and a Russian ship loading grain is spewing grain and dust over the entire area. In addition, the offloading noise the ship is making is above environmentally acceptable limits, sounding like a bad rock concert playing at the back of the boat. Six women are staying on board to protect the boat, since two boats heading to Gaza were already sabotaged in an attempt to prevent us from sailing to Gaza. Four of us are over 60. The Greek naval facility is co-located with the U.S. Embassy compound, which has one warehouse exclusively for the U.S. government, end quote. They close their message with a request that people call the Greek embassy in Washington and the Greek consulates around the country and demand that they release the Audacity of Hope. The number for the Greek embassy in Washington is 202-939-1300. 202-939-1300. They also suggested that people call or send a text message to Kim Richter at the State Department at 202-647-8308. At 647-8308. Rather than attempting to block the Gaza flotilla at sea this year, as it did in 2010, when Israeli commandos killed eight Turkish activists and one American aboard the Mavi Marmara, Israel, no doubt with Washington's assistance, used its clout with Greece, Spain, Cyprus, and France to get those countries to block the ships from even leaving port. Had they been watching the Israeli news carefully, the Gaza flotilla organizers would probably have selected another departure point than Greece. For the past year and a half, since they met in a Moscow restaurant, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and Greek Prime Minister George Papandreou had become close friends. Many of their frequent talks in the past few months have revolved around Greece's severe economic crisis. Netanyahu then decided to come to the aid of his newfound friend in a meeting of foreign ministers and European leaders, imploring them to provide Greece with financial aid. According to an Israeli diplomat quoted by Haaretz, Netanyahu has become Greece's lobbyist to the European Union. To further cement the relationship, on Sunday night, Greek President Karolis Papoulias arrived in Israel on Sunday for a two-day visit, symbolizing the dramatic upgrade in Greek-Israeli ties. As expected, Shimon Peres and Netanyahu heaped praise on Greece for its actions, which effectively put an end to the hopes of flotilla's organizers to sail for Gaza this year. Greece's willingness to genuflect to Israel drew praise from all the leading Jewish organizations, among them JINSA, the Jewish Institute for National Security Affairs, a neocon outfit that Colin Powell blamed for the Iraq War. With extraordinary economic problems and its public in a very bad mood, Jinsa's statement began, the government of Greece seemed an unlikely hero in the saga of the Hamas-organized flotillas. But Greece is indeed the hero. While several countries, including the U.S., denounced the idea of boats breaking legal Israeli-Egyptian blockade of the Hamas government in Gaza, and a few, including Turkey, withdrew government support, it was left to Greece to stop the ships, end quote. Of course, Hamas had nothing to do with the organization, the flotilla, nor did its organizers make any statement supporting the organization. But spreading false information has long been endemic in the pro-Israel establishment, and linking all opposition to the siege and blockade of Gaza to support for Hamas has been a standard way of responding to criticism of its Gaza policy. I should add that where Israel could not get government cooperation, as in Ireland, the boats were sabotaged and prevented from sailing. The stymied Gaza flotilla was followed by what became known as a flotilla, in which a number of Europeans responded to a call from Palestinians in the West Bank to fly into Tel Aviv's Ben-Gurion Airport on July 8th and announce their intent to visit the West Bank. Only 85 of them made it, however, and they were all later deported. Making use of Facebook, it was quite easy for the Israeli government to learn the names of those planning to fly in. That list was sent to all the major airlines scheduled to fly into Tel Aviv that day, and as a consequence, the airlines refused to let some 300 people whose names were on that list board a plane bound for Tel Aviv. Some did manage to do so, however, and they were met there not just by 600 police who had been assigned to block anyone planning to visit the West Bank from getting through. There was also the predictable gaggle of Israeli hooligans. Here's how Larry Durfner, an Israeli-American journalist who usually writes for the Jerusalem Post, described the scene. Quote, "Anybody who believes the platitude that the people want peace, it's just the leaders who want war, should have been at Ben-Gurion Airport today. It's a good thing those free Palestinian activists got arrested, otherwise the little mob that formed spontaneously would have punched them up pretty good. Only minutes after I got to the arrivals hall, wrote Dürfner, a few activists stood in front of the phalanx of reporters and cameramen, held up their little signs and started chanting, "Israel apartheid and free Palestine." I'd written previously here that they were foreign activists who'd just gotten off a plane. I've learned since that they were Israelis. Anyway, the cops tore the signs from their hands and started pushing them toward the exit. After the first couple of minutes of watching in shocked silence, people in the terminal started to boo. Men were cursing loudly, "sons of bees," "garbage," and things in Arabic I didn't understand. A couple of dozen people, mainly men, but also a few women, followed very close behind the tightly bunched demonstrators, cops and reporters, to the police van. "Throw them in the garbage," shouted one woman. An old man tried to get at one of the activists, but the police stopped him. I was there ostensibly as a journalist, and I was scribbling notes, but I felt cowardly not saying anything to these nationalist hooligans, so I started telling them in Hebrew, "What are these people doing?" The woman who wanted them thrown in the garbage said, "They're hurting us." I said, "They're talking." And the little mob turned on me. A couple of the men raised their fists. The woman told me, "Go back home. Get out of here." I said, "I live here." The cops mistook me for a demonstrator, put me in the police van, but when I showed them my press card, they let me go. I do not buy the idea these people are helpless pawns being manipulated by the government, the media, the right-wing politicians, wrote Dürfner. Most Israelis, even if they wouldn't join a mob like the one at the airport, want to hear the belligerent rhetoric the opinion makers are feeding them. They hate anybody who says anything bad about Israel and take their words automatically as blood libels. The opinion makers know this, and the ones who are popular and want to stay that way tell the people what they want to hear. Who's manipulating whom is a chicken and egg question. And that's Larry Dürfner from his article, Mobocracy at Ben Gurion Airport. What we're repeatedly told is the, quote, "only democracy in the Middle East took a long step in the opposite direction on Monday when the Israeli Knesset passed a law that would penalize anyone or any group that calls for boycotting Israel, the settlements, or any person related to the occupation. If someone, for example, calls for a boycott of academic institutions that participate in the occupation, he or she could be sued in civil court in order to pay compensations. If a company agrees not to purchase products manufactured in the settlements, it could be barred from government contracts and sued. If an NGO joins the global boycott to sanctions, divestment and sanctions movement, it could be stripped of its nonprofit status and not only compelled to pay taxes as if it was a commercial firm, but sued as well. The legal advisor of the Knesset voiced grave warnings regarding the legitimacy of the law, Israel having no constitution, and several groups have announced they will petition the High Court to strike it down. The Attorney General of Israel, Yehuda Weinstein, has let the government know he is willing to defend the law at the Israeli High Court. Back in Washington, D.C., Israel's most critical occupied territory, Congress did its bidding once again, following on the heels of a unanimous vote by the Senate last week to suspend aid to the Palestinian Authority should it seek recognition at the UN for Palestinian statehood in September. The House voted 407-6 to do the same last Thursday night, with 13 members having no more courage than to vote present and 10 choosing not to be there. Our representative, Mike Thompson, did not only vote for it, he was one of the bill's 369 sponsors. Resolution 268 was introduced by House Majority Leader Eric Cantor and House Democratic Whip Steny Hoyer. Both resolutions also called on President Obama to use the U.S. power of veto to stop the potential U.N. vote should it reach the Security Council. Three Democrats and three Republicans had the guts to vote no. On the Democratic side were Dennis Kucinich, Nick Rahal from West Virginia, and Earl Blumenauer from Oregon. The Republicans were Ron Paul from Texas, Walter Jones from North Carolina, and Justin Amash, a Tea Party candidate from Michigan, whose family came from Palestine. The resolution, which was probably written and certainly vetted by AIPAC, was welcomed by the Anti-Defamation League, which commended the members of Congress, quote, for mobilizing a resounding message that the Palestinians cannot reject direct negotiations with Israel and embrace Hamas, end quote. Instead of reconciling With Israel, it went on, the Palestinian Authority is reconciled with Hamas, a terrorist, anti-Semitic organization sworn to Israel's destruction. The Palestinians need to take seriously the president's warning that, quote, symbolic actions to isolate Israel at the United Nations in September won't create an independent state. That's the Anti-Defamation League. Well, one thing is for sure, the Palestinians can expect nothing from occupied Washington